thinking of joining a young friends group here in town to support a favorite nonprofit or cause while making new friends who share your interests? If so, I hope you like to drink. I just looked up a good handful of those groups, and one of the main kinds of events they all host is a cocktail party, which is fine, we're all adults. But if you are a non-drinker or just want to keep your drinking to a minimum, the role of alcoholic beverages in Kansas City's social life can be tough to navigate. Enter the booze-free bar. It's a new trend nationwide, including here. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're talking about how to not drink, but still go out and have fun in Kansas City on KCUR's Central Standard. We will get to the booze-free bar. My first guest, though, is David Wayne Reed. Long described by the local media as an actor, writer, and bon vivant, that last part being especially crucial to this conversation. Hi, David.
Hi, Gina.
You are a non-drinker now, but you got that label, bon vivant, back when that was not the case. Can you explain what being a bon vivant meant to you back then?
Well, I didn't know what a bon vivant was until I was called one. I think I was called that by the pitch, maybe, and I had to look it up, and it's someone who loves to indulge in good food and good drink.
Yeah, and so paint a more detailed picture of that time in your life and your role in a in the arts community, really.
Sure. Well, I was a party boy. I was always out. I was always around, and I was a very social drinker. And I'm also naturally a pretty thirsty person. And so those things together can sometimes and did oftentimes lead to overindulgence.
When and why did you stop drinking? We're friends, obviously. I have previous knowledge because of that. But let's revisit that time in your life and that decision as you see it now and for people who weren't there.
Sure. Well, I quit drinking 5.5 years ago. December 15th was the final, the cutoff day. And I drank too much the night before. I think my story is pretty common to a lot of people who stopped drinking. And I woke up the next day feeling pretty rough and terrible about myself. And I didn't want to feel that way any longer. I didn't want to feel embarrassed. I didn't want to feel shameful. I didn't want to feel guilty. I didn't want to feel any of those things that you feel after a night of having too many. And I made a decision to quit. I read a book called The Easy Way to Quit Drinking by Alan Carr, who is famous for writing the book The Easy Way to Quit Smoking, which I also read. I had to read that one a couple times. But I read the book, and he kind of makes you go through a process of a little bit of self-hypnosis in a way, and he asks you at the very end of the book to pour a neat shot of an alcohol that is not your preferred alcohol, and you drink it. I had some vodka, which I hated, and someone left that in my freezer, and I poured a big, neat shot of that, and that's the very last thing I ever drank.
Unconventional method, it sounds like, but it sounds like it worked for you.
It worked for me.
Did it surprise you once you did stop drinking and started going out to kind of notice how much of what we all do together out in the world when we're celebrating and stuff, that how much of that revolves around drinks? Or was that already abundantly clear?
That was already abundantly clear. What was surprising to me was the changes in friendships that come after you make the decision to stop drinking.
Describe that.
You have to tell people that you're a non-drinker all the time. And oftentimes people make it about them because it reflects something back to them. People would say, I didn't think you were that much of an alcoholic, or, you know, or they would say, do you think I'm an alcoholic? And I'm like, I don't know. Do you? People said that all the time. And, you know, I think you stop sharing a risk with people. And
when stop sharing a risk?
You're sober. The other person is drinking. You're not sharing the same experience. You're not sharing the same risk. It's like walking into an acid party and everybody's already dropped, you know, 30 minutes before. You're not going to be on the same level. There's an imbalance right off the top, and that makes people really uncomfortable because it puts that habit, whatever that is, in the spotlight. You know, you also realize you have friendships that can't sustain being, or can't remain while being sober. You know, that was just kind of like part of the relationship. And that can be hard. That was hard.
Can you describe what you mean when you say that you have to tell people you're not drinking all the time?
I have come out publicly about about not drinking, and people will still say to me, in fact, I had a family member recently say to me, "You still not drinking? You still not drinking?" Yeah. Even still.
So like it's interpreted maybe as a phase you're going through, or maybe every
interpreted like a phase. Yeah.
Or like every occasion where there are drinks, people just want to be sure. I am not into chewing gum. Stay with me here. But a friend of mine kept offering me gum all the time. And I was like, "Are you trying to tell me something?" And she's like, "No, I just feel really rude having a piece and not offering it to you." And I was like, "That is so weird. You know I don't want this." And she was like, "But maybe today you do."
Yeah.
And so she was interpreting what she was doing as hospitality. And I was interpreting it as like kind of weird and maybe an insult.
You know, I can turn down a drink. I'm not, it's not about that. I think it's just people's surprise that it's like, "Oh, you're keeping this going." I don't think people believe that I'm going to, you know, like maybe one day I'll just be like, "Okay, I'm going to have a drink now."
What is it like to navigate, say, the bar scene? I mean, there have to be times when there's something going on at a bar where you need to put in an appearance. And in fact, you host a regular event at a bar.
Right.
So it's not like you're not going into those spaces anymore. How do you navigate that?
I drink a lot of 7-Up. And, you know, I don't stay after a certain time. You know, when people start to get messy and are doing shots, it's like, okay, this is my cue to grandpa's got to go home. You know, that's kind of how I feel. I tend to go earlier if I go, or if I do go to a bar, it needs to have something else happening. It needs to be offering something other than drink specials and shots. There needs to be a show, a live show, games, something.
You have been on a couple of cruises as an employee, and these seem to be like milestones in your journey as a non-drinker. I wonder if you can share those stories.
Sure. It's a great story. I quit drinking, and then I was hired to be a team member for a gay cruise ship. And so it is hospitality on all the time. And, you know, drinking is a big part of vacation culture, gay culture, cruise culture. And so I really found my bearings as I was, you know, directing other people to have drinks and have a good time, except that's not what I was doing. I will say the cruise ship does offer a Friends of Bill kind of AA meetup on the ship. But by and large, it's selling the drink experience. And I remember part of my job was going around to all of the bars and making sure everything was hunky-dory. And I stepped up to the bar on the Lido deck. There was a tea dance party happening. And the woman, the bartender, she was from Romania because her badge said so. And she said, "What can I get you, David?" And she saw my badge. "David, do you want something to drink?" And I said, "I'll just have a 7-Up. And she was like, "No vodka, no rum." And I said, "No." And she grabbed both of my hands in hers, and she looked at me and she said, "David, you disappoint me greatly." And I just thought that was so funny that, you know, I'm trying to do my job and I'm still coming off as it's very disappointing to the hospitality culture that I'm not imbibing. I'm not going that route. And I think that's part of the thing. You set yourself apart when you say, no thanks.
You know, so this is clearly universal. You're experiencing it on a cruise ship with a Russian colleague. It's not about Kansas City. But do you think Kansas City has a particular relationship with drinking and socializing?
You know, I remember when I would go on business trips, I didn't drink. But if I was in town, I drank. And I don't know what there was to that, but There's no shortage of places to get your drink on in Kansas City. Drinks are pretty free-flowing here.
I have a friend who's from here originally, but she lived in L.A. for a long time before moving back, and she's a single person and a very social person. And when she started going out as an adult in Kansas City, she was telling me that she felt like participating in all the drinking that was just sort of by default part of that was starting to make her feel physically not good. And so she kind of decided to designate days of the week that were non-drinking days to just sort of like simplify that in her life. But she said that it wasn't that way in LA. I guess people do more stuff that revolves around the outdoors, being active. That's easier when it's sunny and 75. But yeah, is there something to that, do you think?
Well, I think so. Like I was saying, you know, I don't mind going to a bar if there's another activity. I just think that we need to focus on more activities. I was telling Melissa in the green room.
We'll be meeting Melissa in a moment.
It's kind of like deciding to go vegetarian. You know, I've cut meat or alcohol out of my diet, and so I need to find my social nourishment in other places rather than where I was looking at it before. And just being able to provide more options, I think, would help with that. I think it's just a part of our philanthropy circles, our social circles, you said these young friends groups. It's always just the glue, even in our book clubs or, you know, all of it. It's everywhere.
Call 816-235-2888. If you've had thoughts of your own about drinking in Kansas City, how to get out and have fun without drinking, or at least drinking more than you want to. 816-235-2888. I want to introduce our next guest. Melissa Saubers has opened a booze-free bar, a pop-up bar in Kansas City. It's called Sands Bar. It opened at the end of 2018, just in time for New Year's, right?
Yeah, we kicked it off with New Year's Eve.
What prompted you to take this on?
So, like David, I was the consummate party girl. And in 2016, I decided that alcohol was no longer serving me, pun intended. And I quit on June 9th, 2016. I call that my Alcohol Freedom Day. And part of what kept me from not stopping drinking sooner was that I was a very social person. And everything in my life involved alcohol. And so when I decided to take it out, I thought, how am I going to socialize? And found out that we are usually always focused on alcohol in every social circle, whether that be a business networking thing or even my daughter's school functions, charity functions.
Do you feel like it's not just what we're happening to drink, but what we are doing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's really the focus. I mean, I can't even tell you how many times I get invitations to networking events and it's all like free booze. I'm like, well, let's talk about the speaker or the connections that I'm going to make. Let's talk about those types of things, not just the alcohol.
David is part of the arts community. You're coming at this from the entrepreneurial community.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about the role that you see alcohol playing in that community. You've just described it a little, but is it conceivable that people are like missing out on actual opportunities because
yes.
of not choosing to drink?
Absolutely. Before I stopped drinking, I never noticed it. But after I stopped drinking, I noticed that when I would go to these functions, that there weren't any options for people who didn't drink. The event planners didn't think about us. They just thought about the beer and the wine or the cocktail. They didn't think about a creative option for people who don't drink because they automatically assume that everyone drinks. And that's not the case. And there are a myriad of reasons why people don't drink, not just because they're in recovery, but sometimes they want to go pick up their kid from soccer that night, or they want to get up and work out in the morning.
So you open Sands Bar. It's actually based in Austin, but can you describe, first of all, the concept?
Yeah. So the concept is a fun atmosphere, usually with live music or some sort of other entertainment, like maybe a poetry slam night or something like that. We've had three events so far. We have another event this weekend. And we are usually having, like I said, live music. We have handcrafted alcohol-free drinks that are really fun and creative. I wanted to create one of the things that I didn't want to miss out on when I stopped drinking was community, as David was talking about.
Is that why you go from one... like existing establishment to another rather than having a separate space?
Yeah, actually, it's really fun to create a whole new environment and to go to different parts of the city. And yeah, so I just wanted to create community around this topic.
The topic of not drinking.
Yeah.
Melissa Sobers runs Sands Bar. It's an alcoholic pop-up bar here in town. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. You can join the conversation about drinking, networking, and just plain socializing in Kansas City at 816-235-2888. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm here with writer, artist, storyteller David Wayne Reed, as well as Melissa Sobers, owner of Sands Bar KC, where the drinks are flowing. They just don't have booze in them. That's part of an effort to fill a void here in town, a space where people can go out, but where the whole experience does not revolve around alcohol. I've been inviting people to join this conversation by phone. You can certainly keep trying that at 816-235-2888. But we are having a little bit of a phone problem, which we are hoping to get resolved momentarily. In the meantime, you can tweet us. We are at KCURCST. Talk to us there. David, as someone who gave up drinking, this whole idea of a pop-up bar with events specifically oriented toward non-drinkers, would that appeal to you? Or is it like, well, okay, but I want to hang out with specifically my friends who do want to drink and they're somewhere else? I could see that being a sticking point.
Yeah, I think both of those things. I think I'm also at a different place in my life. I'm middle-aged, and I think where you find your community changes and is different. But yeah, I would definitely go to something like that. I like that it provides an activity, just something else where shots are not the main focus.
Melissa, jump in here. Is that something that you thought about this? Because you have had the experience of wanting to hang on to those friendships through this transition into not drinking.
Yeah, what I love is that people who don't drink come. Here's the range of people who come to these events. People who don't want to drink for one night and people who don't want to drink forever. Literally, it is anyone and everyone. I love to see people who are in recovery there with their best friends. They're supporting them. I love to see people who are coming to see the band, and maybe they are drinkers, but they just want to come see the band, or people who are just kind of tired of the booze-soaked society. They just want a little bit of a break. So we have a wide range of people who come to the events.
I know that this is not either, like, neither of you is a scholar on the anthropology of alcohol in our society, but I am curious about your perspectives on this. Just why it is that so much of how we socialize has not just the ingredient of alcohol, but this ingredient that carries so much symbolic meaning. Like if I have a glass of wine in my hand, I feel like that says something not just to other people, but to me about what it is I'm doing right now. Take the glass away and that's maybe less clear, which is weird.
Well, I think that alcohol is glamorized in our society, and obviously the alcohol companies have done a good job of marketing it as a fun way to escape life, to amplify life, and with social media, then that just perpetuates it even further. There's all the memes about mommy needs wine or rosé all
day. Yeah, that one is super weird.
Yeah, so, you know, that just shows people that it's okay to overdrink. I mean, I don't know how many times I've seen mimosas, you know, unlimited bottomless mimosas, you know, at different for brunch or whatever.
Maybe to not even just own that it's just something for fun. It's not like anything bigger than that.
Right. And I think we've taken, with the pendulum has gone too far. You know, there's nothing wrong with drinking. And for me, my goal is not to say, I'm not an anti-drinking person. My goal is to make it easier for people who don't want to drink for any reason at any time, you know, just to give them more options.
David, your thoughts on this just overall, the symbolism of having that glass in your hand?
Well, I think that alcohol provides both identity and community. And when you take the glass away and you stop drinking, your community goes away, your identity goes away. And that's really scary. You know, by holding it, it shows you're part of the party. You're down. You're in it. It's kind of like what I'm saying. You separate yourself from that when you put that glass down. People don't know how to react, or they're like, oh, that person has some problems. Or, you know, there's a lot of gray area because people don't know how to define you then.
Let's hear from our listeners on this. We've got Nancy with us from rural Missouri. Hi, Nancy.
Yeah, hi. Well, I find the same thing. I'm elderly. I'm 80. And I live in a complex. Actually, the town is about 1,000 population. We have one place where people can go and order food and sit and eat, and that's the local bar, and it's very dirty, and it's full of smoke. People are big smokers here. And if you don't smoke and you don't drink, you don't fit in. I live in a complex for seniors, and the American Cancer Society sent me two boxes of literature for people to help them stop smoking, and also about alcohol. And the manager at the complex won't allow me to put it out. She says, we are a smoking complex. And the same way with the local library. They won't let me put this literature in the library.
Well, Nancy, can we get back to this idea of not fitting in? We've been talking about how maybe whether Kansas City has a specific culture around this. Do you feel like your town has a specific culture around this, or that perhaps rural communities more broadly have a specific culture around this?
Well, some of them do, yes. I think this one does in particular. We're right on the Kansas state line. We're on the Miami County, Kansas, and Bates, Cass County line. And the only store in town that really makes lots and lots of money is the smoking outlet. So the Kansans come over here and they buy their cigarettes and their alcohol on our main street, and that's what our town is famous for.
And what is the name of your town?
Drexel.
This is my hometown.
It didn't used to be that way. It didn't used to be that way. I grew up here, and it was an actual town.
But that's what it's become. Let's hear from David on this. It sounds like he has some familiarity.
I grew up, right, I went to preschool in Drexel, and I mean, it's kind of emotional for me actually right now to hear that, because I've seen how Drexel has been decimated by the problems, and I know exactly what bar she's talking about. I know the main street and how it's just a shadow of its former self.
And it sounds like
that makes me so angry that she can't pass out brochures
about the health benefits of not smoking. Okay, let's talk to Teresa. Teresa's calling us from Lenexa. Hi, Teresa.
Good morning. Thanks for having the show. It's an important show. I'm in long-term recovery. I've been sober for well over 20 years. And first of all, my interests have changed. I don't care about being in very crowded, big, loud places. But
is that just maybe less fun when you're not drinking?
Oh, no, not at all.
It's just your interests have changed. I don't mean to project onto you, excuse me.
No, I'm much more interested in having meaningful conversation, for one thing. No. I'm much happier than I ever was before in my life, actually. But there is such a stigma around not drinking, because the liquor industry has perpetuated through their marketing the idea that that having a problem with alcohol is still a moral issue and not a disease, when in fact the AMA proclaimed alcoholism a disease back in the 60s. Having said that, most people don't notice if you're not drinking. And my experience is that on the very rare occasion that someone does make a big deal out of the fact that you're not drinking alcohol, it has almost always been the fact that that person themselves has a problem with alcohol that they don't want to face. And the fact that you're not drinking makes them uncomfortable. So it's really about them and not about you, although it can make the individual who's not drinking uncomfortable.
How do you deal with that? Do you have a technique? Because obviously you aren't going to be like, I'm rubber, you're glue. whatever
no,
you say.
No, no. Well, I don't engage. First of all, I want that person to see that I'm a very happy, comfortable person in my own skin. I'm very comfortable in my own skin. And so I probably will say something light and kind, you know, and absolutely nothing to insult or anger that person. But, you know, I if things got really tense, I might say, you know, if you ever have any questions about recovery, please give me a call.
Well, Teresa, you know. Thank you so much for calling us today.
One other thing, and that is that in bars, I will also say that if you're almost never is there decaffeinated coffee or anything decaffeinated to drink, if you don't want to drink sugar as a also is a health issue, what you're going to end up drinking is water. And I have a good friend. I have a friend who went to a rather highbrow Kentucky Derby party, where there was just all kinds of fancy food and everything in the world at the bar. There was nothing. There was nothing besides water. And I mean, glasses of water.
Yeah.
To drink that was an alcoholic.
You know, it seems like Melissa has something to say about this.
I have a lot to say about this. I call this issue alcohol-free accessibility. And I didn't notice it when I was drinking, but really bars, restaurants, networking events, parties, etc., do not offer thoughtful options for people who don't drink. And so one of my goals is to raise this issue and to actually Stanford calls this equally attractive non-alcoholic beverages. They have all of their new students go through a class, and they say if you're going to throw a party, to have equally attractive non-alcoholic beverages. They call them ENABs. So for every one alcoholic beverage you have a thoughtful non-alcoholic option. And I think if we could just do that one thing, it would make it so much easier for people who don't want to drink everywhere they go. Just
David, you
that
are
one
nodding.
Thing.
You're nodding very vigorously.
Yeah, just to have the option. I mean, people go out of their way. It used to be a vegetarian couldn't find anything. You know, like they would send out, we have some sliced tomatoes.
Yeah.
I had a friend and they gave her sliced tomatoes as her vegetarian meal. You know, now there are so many more vegetarian options because the community has been vocal in seeking those options. And I think it would be smart for bars to be able to offer those options because people do want them. And I will commend, there are several places in town that do offer really good mocktails. I had one of my favorite mocktails downtown. I probably can't mention
No, go ahead.
The Rieger.
They have a good mocktail there.
They had a really great mocktail. And I felt... you know, like I could join the party, like I could hold the wine glass, like you were saying, you know?
Let's talk to Jill in Kansas City, who has a cocktail bar and wants to chime in on this. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
What do you want to say?
I enjoy the conversation. I think there is definitely a trend toward people consuming more responsibly, and we do pride ourselves on offering non-alcoholic options, everything from fresh juices to the more high-end executed non-alcoholic cocktails. In fact, there's a great product that just hit the market. It's called Seedlip Gardens. It's basically fancy flavored distilled water that you can use as a really awesome base for non-alcoholic cocktails. And people can absolutely feel like they're at the party with one of those.
Do you see like this conversation as kind of a conversation about what hospitality is as related to serving alcohol?
Absolutely. Yes, I'm very passionate about not over-serving. In fact, we never drink on the job. I don't believe that a drunk out host can ever be a great host. I think it's irresponsible when you're losing sight of how intoxicated your guests might be getting. So we absolutely do not drink on the job. I mean, we are dedicated to being the best host that we can be. And also not over-serving people. I don't believe that over-serving is hospitality. And I am very passionate about developing business plans that allow us to say no politely when somebody's been over-served. You know, I always say, I'd love you to like us tonight, but I really want you to like us tomorrow. I think that that's part of the conversation that, you know, when we talk about hospitality, over-serving is not hospitality. So you need to be financially structured so that you can afford as a business to say no or to cut someone off or to offer an non-alcoholic option for them instead.
Well, Jill, thank you so much for that call. It does seem, Melissa, that being able to have a business plan that doesn't rely on saying yes to the customer, no matter what they want, is a big part of it. But also just the idea that booze, I understand that that's like a pretty good moneymaker as compared to non-booze.
Yeah. But I think Jill's right on the money when she talks about having options for people who don't want to drink. I mean, I am willing to spend a pretty good chunk of money on a very nice mocktail. Mm-hmm. I actually call them handcrafted alcohol-free drinks versus mocktails. But, you know, that's what they are. And I would definitely pay good money for it.
David, you have sort of within your social group some famous parties. And I'm curious about your idea of how hospitality and drinks go together and whether that idea has changed for you since you stopped drinking.
I have just shifted my focus away from it. You know, I produce a show in a bar at the Brick, and I don't drink. I don't care if other people drink, you know, but there's something else happening. I think it's really just providing something else, another option where the focus is not on doing shots and, you know, there just needs to be something else, just another option.
Let's talk to Mark in Lee's Summit. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
What do you want to share?
I'm a non-drinker. It's not anything. I just never acquired the taste, and I watch kind of the same way. And especially when people that we first meet or in a very casual think it's like we're very religious, which we're not, you know, and they tend to kind of make a judgment. They, you know, don't use cuss words around us or something like that. And, you know, it's not a religious thing. It's, you know, it's just, I just don't like to drink. And then the other thing is they think I'm making a moral judgment on them, saying, you know, oh, you drink, you know, and you know, it's just, for me, I just don't like to drink. And
yeah.
So I think people put more into it than just, oh, okay, you just don't like to drink.
Yeah, Mark, thank you. And I enjoy the chirping birds in the background. It sounds like you're in a delightful setting. I do want to get in one more call before we have to jog on out of here. Melody and Waldo is calling us. Hi, Melody.
Hi. I'm very excited about this topic because it doesn't come up much. And I do a bit with inclusion and diversity within my company. And one of the things we found when asking people, why aren't you coming to the happy hours? We missed you at the mixer, was because they had a cultural or a religious reason for not coming to a place where alcohol was served, or feeling if I was there, my only choices are highly caffeinated sodas and sweet, sweet juices and not well presented. And I think this is very apropos given that it's Pride Month, with the concept that inclusion means that you're invited, but inclusion and diversity means that diversity means you're invited to the party. Inclusion means that you get to dance. So with the concept of you get to hold that glass, you get to be part of the party, especially for these two, what are some of the things that you're doing to maybe include people who otherwise don't find a place in some of our social scenes, feel like they come in and nobody looks like them, they're all drinking, and they have a reason to turn around and walk out? So are there some things they're doing to expand the socializing?
Yeah. So I think we've heard about that they are providing that other focus, and we're going to have to leave it there. But the idea that inclusion means you get to dance at the party is so beautiful. David Wayne Reed, Melissa Saubers, thank you both so much.
Thank you for having me.
Melissa runs Sands Bar KC. It's a pop-up bar without booze. Keep talking about the relationship between drinking and going out here in town. We're at KCURCST on Twitter. Up next, a little self-care. Stay tuned. Does this sound familiar?
You know, you really can't get enough self-care. It's very important, and people just don't do it enough.
I know, self-care. It's a huge buzzword right now. And I think if TV has taught me anything, it has something to do with exfoliating my lips. I'm not sure. The whole concept has become a little bit unclear. So we've invited Sarah Kuchera to help us out. She's a licensed Ayurvedic practitioner, a chiropractor, a yoga instructor. She runs the Sage Center for the Healing Arts, and she has a new book, The Ayurvedic Self-Care Handbook. She also takes issue with how we've distorted the meaning of self-care. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Gina.
We will be talking about your book and your story, but I'd like to start off with this concept of self-care in the title of your book. But you use the term differently than a lot of people.
That's true. I do love the term self-care, but I do feel like it's changed a little bit, even in the process of writing the book and talking about self-care. So since that time, I think that it's changed.
Just a couple of years, I'm guessing.
Yeah, yeah. And in part, I think that that's due to social media. And what I'm seeing is that when we talk about self-care, it's turning into more of an idea of pampering and self-indulgence, which is all great. It's fine that we need those things too. But when I think of self-care, it's leaning more on the side of the continuum that has to do with self-discipline. So I think that at one end we have self-discipline, the other end we have more of like a self-indulgence or a pampering, and then in the middle we have self-care. So all of those things, all of those concepts could be considered self-care, but I lean more towards the self-discipline side.
Can you give an example?
I sure can. So I think that when we think of the things that we need to do to care for ourselves, sometimes it's as simple as going to bed at the same time every night, getting up at the same time every morning, stopping our workday to have lunch. And that's what I consider self-discipline. And that also would be considered self-care because we're doing those basic things that are really nourishing our body and helping us to thrive.
So, you know, it's kind of funny. My producer behind the scenes, we were talking about this, and she was saying, it took me a long time to realize self-care isn't going out for a pedicure. It's unloading my dishwasher.
Exactly. Well, and that's exactly right. When I feel anxious, one of the first things that I do is clean my place because I know if my place is messy or it's scattered, that inside I'm going to feel the same way. So it really is that same thing that getting a pedicure can absolutely be self-care. But the things that I'm talking about are more of like the day-to-day ideas that really fall in line with exactly that, like unloading your dishwasher.
I have enjoyed reading this book that you've written. It's based in Ayurvedic notions of wellness and health. And I think we should start on this by getting a very basic explanation of what Ayurveda is.
Sure. Ayurveda is a system of medicine that originates from India. It's considered to be the oldest sustained form of medicine, and it's based in nature. And you'll also hear this considered to be the sister science to yoga. So a lot of people, such as myself, came to Ayurveda from their yoga practice. Ayurveda being based in nature really teaches us how to live in harmony with nature. And if we talk about that in different terms, that could be paying attention to circadian rhythms, eating seasonally, and just also getting in touch with our own natural self. So with that, it also considers each person to be an individual. And the way that we care for ourselves really differs from one person to the next.
The introduction to your book really captivated me. It's about what resonated for you when you first learned about Ayurveda. You take the reader through your own journey from a farming community in Iowa where you lived in a kind of rhythm with nature, and then into a period in your early career where you were focused on goals and achievement the way most people in their early careers are. So despite being someone pursuing a career in health, you were not feeling your best. Can you kind of walk our listeners through that same journey?
I sure can. And I'll try to be brief because I feel like it was a long journey, even though it was a short period of time. So I kind of got wrapped up in my work as a business owner and also being really passionate about what I do. I've always loved health and I've loved sharing that and teaching other people those same things that help me to feel really well. But in the process of being passionate and being a business owner, I really lost sight of all of the practices that I did in my past to stay healthy. And so I sat with that for a moment and looked back and thought, you know, the time that I really was healthiest was when I was growing up, as you mentioned, in a small town in Iowa. And it may have been by default that I was living more in line with nature because at that time we didn't have the internet, we didn't have the ability to work from home. So my parents had like the 9-to-5 jobs and our days would start and end at the same time. We'd have food at the same time. So I was living in that same synchronicity with nature. And I stopped for a second and thought, you know, I'm not feeling well. I'm working all the time. My days are merging. One's merging into the next. I do know the things to do to take care of myself. And I am doing these things, but it's as if my life doesn't have a container. And when I thought back to this and looked at when I grew up, my life had a container. And one of the foundational concepts in Ayurveda is that we have daily routine, we have nightly routine, and we have seasonal routine. And even though I was doing a lot of those things, they weren't happening at the same time. So it really was that I needed to focus more on the how and the when instead of just the what.
Why do you think that matters?
I think it matters because right now we're so out of touch with nature. And, you know, maybe at some point I'll get tired of that phrase myself, such as I did a little bit with the idea of self-care. But I think we're really losing this connection that we are in rhythm with what's happening in our external environment.
Yeah, like it got dark, I stopped.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And we didn't have, if you didn't have light to help you work, you couldn't work, you know, especially if you were a farmer. And so I think that that's important because that's what's giving us sort of the natural ebb and flow of our life, that if we can have work at any time, we will work at any time. So there's nothing that's telling us to actually stop.
There's actually a lot telling us to keep going.
A lot. And I think that we live right now in a society that's not only pushing us to do so many things and to do so many things all the time, but it's still continuing to tell us always do the best that you can do all the time. And those things are hard to do together.
Tell me more, though, about this picture of childhood. You write in the book that when you were sitting there thinking, when was I living my healthiest life? You pictured specifically being 9. And can you tell what the sort of details around that were that are maybe like your homing call or something if you mm-hmm. were a pigeon?
Yeah, sure. So I guess 9 was a good year for me. Maybe my best year yet. I was always outside, and I really remember being in different activities that took me outside, and summers at the pool, and everything had such a distinct outline to it that fall felt a certain way. And my mom would decorate the house in a certain way for fall. She'd decorate in a certain way for different holidays. And that there's something about that that's so comforting. And I can even think back to a time when or think back specifically to, you know, after dinner, we might move to the living room and the kitchen would be clean and dimly lit, and we'd be watching TV in the living room or playing a game. And there's something super comforting about that. And it could be that I was under the care of someone else. Like, I didn't have those worries. But
that's
I really
nice.
Think there's something. Yeah, that's nice at 9 and at any age. But I think that there's something more to that. And that's really, you know, if that idea of having those comforts then, if that helped then, why can't it help me now?
So what is the non-9-year-old version?
The non-9-year-old
for
version,
you.
Such as how I am today.
Yeah.
So I do incorporate a lot of those things now, that when the seasons change, I change. I may not change the decorations where I live, but I do change the things that I'm doing, such as my bedtime is different. I'm eating different foods. So I'm still using the concept of creating my life around the seasons and the day and the timing. It's just that those activities are a little bit different.
I want to bring this back to the two ideas we started with, both self-care and Ayurveda. You write that it's quite possible that the most comforting thing Ayurveda has to offer is its ability to understand you as you are, not some hypothetical you from a textbook. Can you explain that?
I can. In the system of Ayurveda, there's something called a dosha, and our dosha is our constitution, and this is something that's inherent within us. So it's sort of the reason why your eye color is what it is, your bone structure is what it is, why you're interested in certain things, and also your vulnerabilities. So perhaps why you might have certain emotional tendencies or certain physical vulnerabilities. Everyone has a different constitution, so There are actually only 3 doshas, but we are made up of all of them because these represent different things that happen in our body. So you can't say that you're not one of those 3, but one or two of those will resonate with you most. And if you and I are the same constitution or we have the same dosha, that doesn't mean that we're the same. It just means that we might have similar characteristics about us. And so when you start to learn about Ayurveda and you learn about how this system is recognizing that you might love tomatoes and tomatoes work really well for you, but I may not like tomatoes or tomatoes don't work well for me, and why those things are the way they are, it really resonates. And I don't think that there's another system that really pays attention in that same way.
My understanding of it, and correct me if I'm wrong, is also, though, that this isn't totally like incompatible with Western medicine.
Absolutely. It's for sure compatible, and it's in many ways. I think every medicine, in my opinion, has its place. I'm not one that would ever say to never take a pharmaceutical, as I know that some people who practice more holistic forms of medicine are sort of against that. And I am not that way at all. I think that what we need to do is take care of ourselves when we can so that we can use things like our food and our lifestyle to really stay healthy. And that's really what Ayurveda does. If we can look at Ayurveda as something that can help us to heal different conditions or to help be sort of like an adjunct care when we're dealing with more deeply manifested conditions. But on the forefront of things, it's really about how can you take care of yourself now, like every day, so that you don't have to deal with those more severe conditions later.
So when you talk about doshas, there's some language that might be like the way people typically talk about the things you are describing. Like some people saying like, are you a morning person or a night person? Is mm-hmm. Is that something that someone talking about the same phenomenon through the lens of Ayurveda would talk about while referring to what dosha is like?
It sure could be. It's similar to this. In fact, so the three doshas are called Vata, Pitta, and Kapha. And I know that our Kapha people like to sleep. And so they're not really going to be the morning people, but they're also not the night owls. And so, yeah, each dosha sort of has its...
They're the blanket people.
Yes, they're the blanket people. Whereas our Vata constitution is more sporadic. They don't really want to have a schedule. Maybe one night they'll stay up late. Maybe another night they won't. And yeah, so you do have some of those things that go along with the different constitutions.
The tips in your book on self-care are very, very simple things when taken one by one. The totality of it, like if you were to follow all of these things, it would be a really rigorous discipline, as you were describing. But some of the tips in the book are things just like how to consume water. So like your advice is drink a full glass of water when you wake up and then just sip throughout the day. So using that as an example, can you explain how that embodies self-care to you?
Sure. I think that goes back to what I was saying about self-discipline. So we're talking about a basic need, such as drinking water. And how many times have you stopped? Maybe you carry a water bottle.
I totally do. And I often, it stays full all day.
Exactly. And so that's exactly what I'm talking about, that there are so many times where you might stop and look at your bottle and think, like, that is still full. I have had no water today. And then you'll chug it all at once. And
you're making up for lost time. This is totally how I do it.
Yeah, yeah. So it's those little things that when you drink water throughout the day, and the idea of sipping water has to do with it not impacting our digestion in a negative way. We view our digestion as a fire. And so drinking a lot of water at once can sometimes put out our digestive fire, making it harder to actually break down food and get nutrients. So that's the reason for sipping throughout the day. So a lot of those concepts I'm talking about really have to do with the basics of what we need, not the pedicures.
So, and then there's this other tip involving scraping your tongue, which I think might sound like such a crazy concept if you've never done it. But can you describe what that's all about?
Mm-hmm.
It's like such a small thing, but it's fascinating to me.
It's a small thing. And I think that when you learn about it and you start it, you can't help but be addicted to scraping your tongue. So using a tongue cleaner is one of the first things that you do in the morning. And I think it's another great example of something that takes like little to no time to do that can really help you. And using a tongue cleaner means that you're using, it's sort of a U-shaped, made up of a different, maybe a metal like stainless steel, could be made of copper. And you clean your tongue with this, and by using it, you'll see what you're cleaning off your tongue. And that's actually telling you what's happening throughout your entire digestive tract. So by doing this in the morning, you're scraping off not only what has accumulated in your body throughout the night, it's telling you what those things mean. And it's also opening up your digestive system to being more effective throughout the day.
When you think about the way that people talk about self-care, which is very different from scraping your tongue or consuming water throughout the day in small intervals rather than like chugging it. Those are really small things. What do you think of why it is that we think it has to be something big, something expensive often?
I think that there's some glamour behind it, and that's attractive, whether that's based off of just the idea of marketing and advertising. But yeah, there's more flair to that. But we don't really need that flair.
Sarah Kuchera, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sarah is the head honcho over at the Sage Center for Healing Arts, and her book is The Ayurvedic Self-Care Handbook, Holistic Healing Rituals for Every Day and Season. That's a wrap. You can listen to both conversations we hosted this morning, one about self-care and one about the prevalence of drinking in our social scene, at kcur.org/centralstandard. Grab those later today. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we'll check in on election results through the lens of struggling neighborhoods surrounding a prosperous downtown. We'll also hear how loneliness affects our health on KCUR's Central Standard. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Salisa Kalakal, Anne Knigendorf, and intern Riley Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.